Good afternoon. It's Friday the 28th of July 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson, and joining me today via video link, David Scott. Welcome to the programme, David.
Good afternoon, Mike.
Right, we're going to get straight on, David, with Grenfell Tower. Just one item on this today, and it was this. We were very interested to note that... Well, this is securitycleardjobs.com, but this was listed on other job sites as well. Recruiting for outsourcing investigators, large number of investigators. It's not specified how many in this advertisement to work on the Grenfell Tower inquiry, Operation Northleigh, for the Metropolitan Police. The key responsibilities are scene attendance appreciation, interrogation and analysis information from open source and MPS, that's Metropolitan Police Service data sources, statement taking, victim liaison, movement of documents and exhibits, including logistics, continuity and transport. And they're looking for people with previous experience of working in criminal investigations or intelligence environments, preferably within the past 3 years. They need to be IT literate, and that means apparently Microsoft Word and Excel. And they need to have previous experience of working within a major crime stroke murder investigation. This is quite incredible on the face of it, David, because what seems to be being acknowledged here is that the police don't have the resource or the manpower to resource this this investigation.
Very strange indeed. The timing alone, the whole issue about investigating a crime is it's got to be done quickly. We don't want information to be lost. We don't want evidence to be destroyed. So we are recruiting now. Now that means that the investigation up until now has not had enough resources. That means that they're struggling. That means that we're going to essentially get to some of this information gathering only months after the event. It seems absolutely extraordinary.
Right, so that's some good points there. Now, what's interesting is the job application closes on the 24th of August 2017, and it says that the contract is due to run until March 2018. I presume it would be renewed if it needs to run on any longer than that, but there clearly are going to be no quick answers here.
Yes, and from a staff procurement point of view, I mean, this is quite specialist skills you're looking for. How many people who have advanced criminal investigation skills are going to be roaming around looking for a 6-month contract? It's not even all that well paid. It seems a desperate measure, and it seems a desperate measure not likely to yield significant extra resources.
Indeed. Okay. Well, let's move on to Brexit news now, and this from the Independent, the Irish Independent, and the headline is "Absurd and Unconstitutional: DUP Dismisses Suggestion from Convey, from Coveney, sorry, to move border to Irish Sea after Brexit." And what is being suggested here, David, is that the border between Britain and Ireland post-Brexit would be moved to the Irish Sea, which would mean that if you wanted to travel, for example, from London to Belfast or from Glasgow to Belfast, all cities within the United Kingdom, that you would be required to pass through passport control and effectively the border in order to do that. And this seems to be, on one hand, a possible solution to the issue of the land border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. But clearly, half the population of Northern Ireland is not going to look on this situation with huge respect or enthusiasm.
No, the population of Northern Ireland who wish to remain part of Britain, which remains the majority, I will look back on a century of struggle to maintain that link, and look at the idea that for sheer administrative neatness, that these ties are to be thrown away with a good deal of disgust, I would have thought. I don't think that's going to go down tremendously well. It shows you the lack of really acute thought that's being applied to the problems that... that come from Brexit. I do remember we seem to manage quite okay with having links to Northern Ireland in much more difficult circumstances in the 70s.
Well, that's absolutely right. And the Alex Thompson mentioned, of course, in the past, the issue here is a non-issue because there was an agreement between the Republic of Ireland and the United Kingdom regarding free movement across the Irish border before we ever joined the European Union or Ireland ever joined the European Union. So you would have thought that all they actually needed to do was to move back to that previous arrangement.
You would have thought, I mean, it is complicated with the fact that Ireland has unlimited free movement in from the EU, and that's going to be a problem for Ireland, but it doesn't seem to be something that requires a complete change to the British constitutional arrangements.
Absolutely. Okay, we'll move on to Ardassir. Now, we've got a very nice picture of the coastline there. Just remind us what this story is actually about.
Yes, I want to put this picture up because it's worth just remembering that it's an extremely beautiful part of the world. This is the area of the key ongoing dispute at Ardassir, right? And it looks out over the bay here, and in that bay there are many dolphins and sea life, and it's a very special part of the world indeed. Now, the issue here is twofold. There has been in the long background a very large development, which requires a sewage works, and that sewage works is going to be in Ardassir. Now, one of the problems is the people of Ardassir don't want it there, and the initial assessment of all these various sites had Ardassir as the least suitable site. All of a sudden, this assessment was revised, reviewed in private, without any public scrutiny, and the last became first, and the first last. And the whole plant was put into Ardassir against the wishes of the people. And through a whole series of bits of planning law which were maladministered and general lack of listening to the community, the community got railroaded and have had this this work imposed upon them. Now, the way that the developer and their agents, Scottish Water, now Scottish Water have a quasi-judicial role here. They're a statutory undertaker, but they're also a private company, or have a private company, of Scottish Water Horizons, who are working as agents for the developer. So the private-public split becomes very murky here. So this private developer operating through Scottish Water Horizons has approached the whole situation in the most high-handed of manners. And what's happened is that eventually the lack of engagement with the community and the tendency to be essentially arrogant has actually caught them out, because they have planned this pipeline for many, many years, but they have actually not asked permission from some of the landowners in the land that they're planning to cross. So rather than admit their mistake, they are trying to barge ahead with the work and deny the property rights of the landowners in question. There's two homeowners, two families, whose land they want to cross, and they refuse to ask permission. They refuse to negotiate, they refuse to serve proper notices. They're basically trying to ride roughshod over the property rights of the families involved. And when caught on this, and it was pointed out to them, this next email shows their response. The little highlighted bit says...
I'm firmly of the view now we need to get this work complete through the stretch of land quickly to avoid further issues which may go against the normal process for engaging with local community.
So we're going to ditch the limited amount of engagement we're meant to have with the local community, and we're going to charge on because that's the easiest way to get where we want. Now, this ignores the local community. It also ignores a little thing we like to call the law. And what has happened is the villagers of Ardassir have rallied to the support of their neighbours whose property rights are being infringed. The area in question has become a bit of a party spot. The title deeds of the properties include permission to have boats there because it's right down on the foreshore. The title deeds extends to the foreshore. So a whole lot of children's rubber dinghies have appeared. People sit in them, and there's also rights for fishing. So there's a paddling pool with children's fishing set. So the people are down there playing with the kids and fishing, and having chats with one another, and occupying the land. Scottish Water officials came up and asked them to move, and they politely declined. Whereon the Scottish Water officials threatened them with dire legal consequences and legal action. Now, this raises a whole lot of other very interesting legal questions, because here we have Scottish Water, who do not have legal title to the land, do not have permission from the landowner, and yet they are threatening to have people removed via the Scottish court system and a court order if they can get one. This is completely unlawful. What possible mechanism could they have? If you could do that, then presumably we can apply to the Scottish court system to have all the people in the Scottish Water head office removed from the Scottish Water head office. I mean, presumably if you can just apply to the court system to have people moved around the country, there's no limit. So they seem to have a very odd conundrum that they have created for themselves. And again, it's by their own ignorance and arrogance and refusal to actually ask permission and negotiate with the landowners in a proper business-like manner that bears in mind that we are all equal in a common law jurisdiction.
That is a good question. Is it, do you think it's incompetence, or do you think it is an effort to set precedent?
Well, this is a very good question, and I don't really know. My initial response is this is the culture. There's a culture. Some of their internal documents that describe what they can do and the rights they have are actually unlawful. The things that they are telling, Scottish Water are telling their staff, are not what's in the statute. They're claiming more powers than they actually have. So there's a culture within the organisation that we have the right and we can impose our will. And when this has been pointed out, the kind of cognitive dissonance of someone saying, no, this is my property, you need to ask permission. And unless you do and we negotiate properly, the answer is no, go away. That has just not been able to be processed by an organisation that's been too long used to being able to intimidate people. And remember how they intimidate people. We'll take you to court. We are an organisation with £100 billion reserves. We can have unlimited court time. And we will run up an unlimited bill and we will charge you for it. So, Mr. Homeowner, do you fancy betting everything on this? That's the game they play.
Yeah. OK, well, let's move on to Police Scotland then. And Mr. Gormley, what's he up to, Phil Gormley?
Well, he's been charged with bullying. I'm sure you find this very difficult to believe, but the head of Police Scotland has actually turned out to be in a bit of trouble again. Now, Mr. Gormley was brought in after the catastrophe that was for Stephen House. So Stephen House left the force in a shambles. Every policeman I spoke to around that time knew that Sir Stephen House had abandoned his wife and children, had moved in with his gay lover and all the rest of it. It wasn't reported in the press. It was all secret, but it was the talk of the police force. Everybody knew. And Mr. House left early. Mr. Gormley came in, and now he's been accused of bullying. I think it was a superintendent. So that's being investigated by PIRC. And if PIRC consider that he is guilty of this, he may have to resign. Or be fired. So we'll see how that works out. The next slide there is the second in command, or the one just before that, sorry.
Oh, sorry.
The second in command of, this chap here, of Police Scotland, he's resigning. And the Daily Record are reporting that from what they hear, the whole senior management team are on the way out. Mr. Gormley will be leaving early, and a series of other senior managers in Police Scotland are going to leave. So the crisis, the ongoing catastrophe that is Police Scotland seems to be going on. And where we have honest police officers around the country who are doing their best for the local community, as the people on the ground in Ardersier are doing for their community, the police in Ardersier have been excellent over the events there. I really feel for the police officers because they are not being well led.
And who is Rose Fitzpatrick then?
I'm not absolutely sure. I haven't researched this lady. She's obviously tipped for the job, but I'll need to talk to you perhaps next week about
that. Okay, well, let's move on to police in England and Wales then, because, I think we mentioned this some time ago, that they were going to run this survey of police officers in England and Wales. But the Police Federation and they represent about 123,000 officers, they are running a survey on whether police in England and Wales want to carry a gun. Federation have said that the question of routinely arming police officers is a challenging one and one that regularly crops up. But given the current climate, we feel it time to ask the views of our members again. Policing has changed significantly over the years, not just around the types of crime we're dealing with and greater use of technology, but also the threat, harm and risk to the public and to officers themselves. This survey seeks to determine our members' views to inform our position on the issue of routine arming. Over the last few years, a handful of forces have been surveyed individually on this issue, where we're keen to establish a fresh national view. What's your view, David?
I don't think it's their call. I think it's the people of this country who should decide what arms the police carry, because I understood, perhaps naively, that we are policed by consent. So if consent means that they have all the guns and we have none, and do what you're told, that doesn't seem to be in accordance with the traditions of British policing.
Absolutely. Well, here's the view of the National Police Chiefs Council. This is Simon Chesterman, the lead on armed policing for the NPCC. He said, "We've got the firearms uplift going on at the moment, and that is increasing the number of armed police in areas deemed to be at greatest risk from a sophisticated attack of the kind we saw in Paris. But recent events of low sophistication terrorist attacks have led us to debate about whether we have the right levels in the right places." So, you know, clearly pressure coming from the police authorities themselves to move in that direction. I'm not certain that that is something that which is necessarily supported by the public at large.
No. And the terror attacks have perhaps changed this a little bit. But when they're trying to introduce a lot of armed police under Sustained House into Scotland, it went very badly. And essentially the public reaction defeated it, because people were going up to police officers who were perhaps wandering around the local Tesco armed to the teeth, getting their lunch, and pointing out that this wasn't wanted. And they were taking photographs of this, and it was going in the press. And all in all, there was outrage against it. Now, I hope we still have the guts to have that outrage after the terror attacks of earlier this year, to have a proper debate about how to respond to that and not simply allow the knee-jerk reaction, oh, we must give up our freedom for our safety, to take over.
Yeah. Okay, now let's have a look at this one. Former Justice Secretary Kenny McCaskill has advocated the creation of secure old folks' homes to deal with the problem. Which problem is that, David?
We're locking up too many old people. There is an increasing number of decrepit elderly in the Scottish jails, and they're not able to wash themselves, to look after their cells, to get in and out of bunk beds, and some of them are even wheelchair-bound, and the prison service is not equipped to deal with these people. They're in fact spending £1 million a year in Scotland alone bringing in specialists in elderly care to deliver care packages, and this is social care, to prisoners. So we're locking up people who cannot not actually look after themselves, and then bringing people in to wash them and look after them. Now, this is a very strange situation, and it is, of course, related to child sexual abuse, because why are we suddenly locking up all of these old people? Well, this is the historical child sexual abuse cases starting to come through the system, quietly, one by one, but we're seeing the scope of it, the size of it, even with the very limited investigation and prosecution that's been going on. We see the scope of it here in the problems created for the prison service and dealing with the people thus convicted.
Okay, well, that's moved us on to sort of health-related issues, and you wanted to highlight this from the Daily Record. This is the ultimate slap in the face. Former soldier lost his legs in Afghanistan, but English hospital will no longer treat him because he's Scottish.
Yes. Now, this is very tragic. I mean, he is a young man. He's given his legs. He's given his... he's in constant pain. He lost two-thirds of his body weight as he was recovering from this injury. I mean, he's given so much for his country, and his country has put him into this situation I think very unwisely, and has an obligation to look after him. And the hospital said that they were ashamed to say it, but they couldn't look after him anymore because he was the wrong sort of British. He joined the British army, but an English hospital will not look after him because he is resident in Scotland. Now, there are no appropriate facilities in Scotland. So here you see the bureaucracy of the NHS, the odd dividing lines between parts of the NHS and the constant chase for money saving that has become an inevitable consequence of the NHS sort of put into stark relief. But you also see something else. I think some years ago there would have been sufficient wisdom in the management of the NHS, even the NHS of the 1970s, to say, we will not say that to this soldier. We will not tell him we're not going to treat him. We will find another way behind the scenes to move money around, whatever it takes, so that this man does not even know that his care is under threat. But that's not the way it works anymore. No, we say to this young man that he's going to have to go elsewhere for his treatment.
Okay, well, let's look at some broader health-related issues, because I noticed various reports over the last 24, 48 hours on the issue of human embryo gene editing. Because the first gene editing experiments have now been carried out in the United States. So earlier on today, I spoke to Dr. Graham Downing on this issue. So we'll have a look at that, and then we'll get David's comments afterwards. So the first human embryos have been gene edited in the United States. This is the first time it's been done in a Western country. And this is the organization that's done it, the Center for Embryonic Research and Gene Therapy. It's the first known attempt at creating genetically modified human embryos. And of course, they're saying that this is in order to cure disease. They changed the DNA of a large number of one cell embryos. And they used a new technique called CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R. Three previous attempts at editing human embryos have been published by scientists in China. But as I say, this is the first time it's happened in the West. So this is new ground broken. They are attempting to deal with inherited diseases, is what they say. None of the embryos was allowed to develop for more than a few days. They say that they had never any intention of implanting these in a womb. This is, some people saying that it is inevitable that we move in this direction, but that is part of the question that we're going to investigate in a second. Now, the person leading this drive is a guy called Dr. Shukrat Mitalipov, here's what he has to say on the issue.
My name is Shukrat Mitalipov, and I am a professor here at OFSU. We're actually correcting this disease before even embryo is formed. So we're correcting it in the egg that hasn't been fertilized, and the family can have a healthy child. I like it in my job because it's excitement of a discovery. So every day come exciting that we will move forward and we'll find what we're looking for, and I think that's the most exciting part to being a researcher.
So that's his view. Now, James Clapper, the former Director of National Intelligence, had a different view just over a year ago when he published the annual Worldwide Threat Assessment Report for the U.S. intelligence community. This is the NSA, the CIA, and various other three-letter agencies. And they suggested that gene editing, well, they actually added gene editing to a list of threats posed by weapons of mass destruction and proliferation. And although it doesn't mention the specific technique that this organization has used, CRISPR by name, they are absolutely had the sort of most recent gene editing systems in mind. So the report said research in genome editing conducted by countries with different regulatory or ethical standards than those of Western countries probably increases the risk of the creation of potentially harmful biological agents or products. So joining me to discuss this is Dr. Graham Downing. Welcome to the program, Graham.
Hi, Mike. Good to hear your voice.
Is James Clapper correct in his assessment of this situation, or how do you see it?
This is a really complex area of science, and it's an area that's not well understood. So from the, just off the bat, you're starting to tread very into territory that's a very dangerous territory. Second is the problem is with this is that whereas you would need millions of pounds or millions of dollars worth of kit and funding in order to bring about changes like this or changes along the line to this, now you can do this stuff with hundreds of dollars. You know, it doesn't cost a lot of money to now start to muck around with this technology, and that's the real problem. I think that's what he's saying is suddenly, you know, and also the thing is that we mentioned this before, it's you don't need vast space and many, many technicians. You can do this in a room somewhere and largely go undetected. It's not like it was, this is radioactive material and all that kind of stuff, which I think is heavily monitored. So he's not wrong in that regard.
But what seems to be happening here is that the West has now decided to ply ahead with this. this is only one academic organization for sure. But is it the case that we're starting to move ahead with this because China has decided to? Because if that's the case, then it's starting to look a bit like an arms race.
Yeah, I mean, China has been pushing this forward. And I think lots of scientists in the West have looked on with envy because scientists want to discover new stuff. And that's what they want to do, you know, and I don't think they should look on with envy. I think that's a terrible thing because you need to be very cautious because how many times can you keep opening up the forbidden cookie jar before you open up the wrong one? And the problem with this is there's two basic types of cell, if you like. You've got somatic cell and you've got germline. Now, somatic cells won't be passed down the next generation. So if you make an error there, you're not going to affect the wider human genome. But what they're now talking about is putting changes into DNA that are going to be passed down and that potentially can be passed into the wider human genome. And that's the problem. And, you know, I mean, there's been broad consensus to not do this worldwide. And what's happened, I think you're right, because China's moved forward with this, that we used to have a red light on this. And we haven't necessarily gone to a green light, but it's now kind of moved to amber. And that appears to be the problem at the moment.
Of course, the doctors concerned say that they are particularly concerned with helping people and curing disease, particularly inherited disease. James Clapper, on the other hand, suggesting that this could be turned into some kind of biological weapon. But the other issue here is the other sort of lucrative potential of this is for eugenics, designer babies, as people prefer to call it. That's another danger.
The problem with this is, even though, we haven't got a red light on this anymore, whereas we used to have a red light on mucking around with germ cell lines. Now we've gone to amber. So what's going to happen is they're going to say, well, we can develop this now for inherited diseases. And you've got things like sickle cell, I think recessive deafness, things like that, which obviously are problematic and awful for people. And if they can help those, absolutely fantastic. But what's going to happen is it's then once they develop all this technology, it's not going to stop there. It's going to sidestep. And then, now you're talking eugenics on a huge scale, which, you're talking about intelligence, you're talking about color of hair, all this kind of stuff. Now, the problem with this is that really these things aren't as simple as what they're making out, because there's not necessarily one gene causes one change in a person. There's combinations of genes. So there's multiple hurdles along the line. It's not just a simple thing. Even if they give this the green light, and even if it was a wonderful, amazing world where you could do all this stuff. So there's massive technical hurdles to this as well. And I was saying before, the problem is how many times can you go to the forbidden cookie jar before you open up the wrong one and you take a bite of a poisonous cookie? Because that's what's going to happen with this. And as I kind of mentioned before, is that this technology is now available, low scale, is not detectable and can be done for hundreds of dollars. And this is a huge problem. And I would agree that it does pose a danger. And I think how they're going to regulate this, I don't even think you can regulate this, quite frankly. I think it's a nightmare.
Well, that's a pretty dark assessment. So the final question then, Graham, is are we just being overly negative on this? because obviously the potential rewards, well, maybe you could comment on what the potential rewards are. Are we actually capable of pursuing this form of research and doing it in an ethical way?
I think you aren't. I don't think you can control this technology. I think it can be done ethically, and it should. And in some sense, you should help someone that has an issue having a child, or a child that's born. Well, actually, they're talking before birth, having a problem that may result in their death or misery. We're not suggesting that they shouldn't do that, but the problem of this is that once you let the cat out of the bag with this, it's going to be almost impossible to control it. And the other thing is we're looking at the moment in a world where we have human dignity as primacy. As we're moving into the fourth industrial revolution, where AI is going to ascend to primacy, and it absolutely is, and the human beings are starting to be looked more in a functional way and in an economical way, which is straight out of the mouths of the leaders of this new AI revolution, then this technology, I suggest, is going to be sidestepped, and we aren't going to be the benefactors of it. It's actually going to be detrimental to the human race. So there are massive things to be looked at here. It isn't just a simple case of let's all live in this wonderful world and make everybody healthy, which of course we would love. But there are serious implications to this.
Okay, Graham, thank you very much, Dr. Graham Downing. So what do you think, David, can this be pursued in an ethical manner?
When I hear reports on this, the thing that comes to mind is the story of a Tower of Babel. I was looking it up here. It says, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do. Now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. And what worries me is what humanity will imagine to do, because we can imagine some pretty horrible things.
We can imagine some pretty good things as well, if we're taking a positive view.
Well, we can, but what's the restraint here? What's the incentive? Where is the restraint coming from? Right? Where is the restraint on what they will do? If there's an incentive, they'll do it. You know, this is the nature of humanity. We're not notable for wonderful levels of self-restraint and far-sightedness. We tend to be operating on a much shorter time horizon in the interest of self-interest, and such things as ambition, greed, lust for power, or lust for fame. And all of these things will tend to drive technology like that into some areas which will exceed, I would suggest, the wisdom of many of the people who will be employing.
Brings us very nicely onto global trade, because we've been talking about this over the last couple of weeks. And Liam Fox is in Mexico, was yesterday at least. So the globalist trade deal agenda is moving on. Boris Johnson, by the way, and Michael Fallon are both in Australia at the moment pursuing similar exercise over there. But Fox was speaking at an event hosted by HSBC in Mexico yesterday, and he began by saying it's fitting that we're hosted by HSBC, the largest UK investor in Mexico. And it is fitting indeed, since the UK government is at the heart of the global drugs business, and HSBC is the money launderer of choice. And as we know,
And founded by Scottish drug dealers.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Don't forget that.
But we should remember that in 2012, HSBC paid $1.92 billion in a so-called deferred prosecution agreement. This is one of these agreements where they pay a fine, they don't get prosecuted, and then they're supposed to push through certain reforms which are going to make sure they don't commit the same offence again. And so they paid $1.92 billion in 2012 on the issue of laundering money for drugs cartels. That, in the scale of HSBC, was no more than a slap in the wrist, but they did it anyway. But in the meantime, they were expected to comply with certain conditions. And so there was an agreement put in place, the deferred prosecution agreement. but whether or not they're complying with that agreement is still utterly secret. And so one mortgage holder, Hubert Dean Moore Jr. in the United States, tried to get his hands on a 1,000-page report, which is compiled by a court-appointed monitor, on whether or not HSBC was complying with this agreement. And he had the support of a federal judge in his pursuit. But that has been blocked because, of course, when you've got a key player in the global drugs business, you've got to protect them, don't you? So that's basically what's happened. So I think it's very appropriate that Liam Fox in Mexico was being hosted by HSBC. And we wait to see, you know, whether this particular case continues to be moved along, or whether this is the end of the story for whether we get any oversight on whether HSBC is complying with the agreement that they made. As I say, in the meantime, Michael Fallon and Boris Johnson in Australia. So here's the Ministry of Defence tweeting out that the Defence Secretary met with the Australian Minister for Defence and Industry to talk about boosting exports and innovation collaboration, hashtag Global Britain, because it's all that's where we're going. What did Boris Johnson have to say? He said he was talking about global trade agreements in his speech that he was giving yesterday in Australia. And he said he made this comment. This leads us into the next section, David, but I just thought it was a spectacular comment out of his speech. If you look at the five worst current humanitarian disasters in Syria, South Sudan, Somalia, Yemen, and Northeast Nigeria, you find that the three biggest donors are the US, the UK, and the EU. And I thought, he's telling us something here, because he is admitting, I believe, you may have a different view, he is admitting that the three biggest donors, being the US, the UK, and the EU, pushing money into these areas, they are creating these humanitarian disasters and this war and conflict, because that's what drives global trade with the military-industrial complex at its heart.
Yeah, the aid is toxic. The aid is harmful. It's the helping that's killing these people. We need to stop helping, right? Stop helping us in this way, because free trade. They call it free trade, of course. Free trade is what helps Africa and the Middle East, because you get all the advantages of an international scale division of labor. But we don't have free trade. We don't have anything like it. The American Heart Foundation, Heart Association, has declared that coconut oil is deadly, it kills you, which is nonsense, and far more harmful grain-based oils, which are made in the United States, and where there's a financial incentive to back up that industry, they should be consumed instead. So you have this lie upon lie upon lie. And as soon as you start saying, well, we're not going to have free trade exactly. What we're going to have is regulated trade, and we're going to have the benign hand of government controlling things and limiting what you can do and excluding some products and subsidizing some products and putting tariffs on some products in their wisdom. Then the next thing that happens is those powers are captured by powerful vested interest companies like HSBC, and the whole international trade environment gets more and more skewed, more and more controlled to the benefit of the well-connected.
Yeah, but David, this is what the rules-based international order is. This is what they mean by that.
Yes, it's the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules, and that way he keeps the gold. It's not free trade. They will constantly call it free trade. We shouldn't allow them to use big words they don't understand.
Yeah, okay. We'll just remind everybody of Yemen and the war that continues in that part of the world. Foreign Policy magazine here pointing out that the war in Yemen has killed or wounded 4,000 children in recent days and months. More than 90 civilians, 25 children died in one single airstrike in March 2016, 10 more children in another airstrike on a school. This is all Saudi Arabia, one of our greatest free trading partners, particularly in the arms industry. And even the UNICEF making a statement on this issue because, of course, they're particularly concerned with the world's worst cholera outbreak. David, it staggers me that this conflict continues to get almost no coverage in the mainstream media, that the British public have almost no idea of what's actually going on in that part of the world. And in fact, it's our government and our government's willingness to support Saudi Arabia and particularly support it with arms trades and arms deals that is causing this conflict to take place. The British public apparently has nothing to say on it, whereas they, if they knew about it, perhaps they might.
Yes, and meanwhile, our media tell us that Assad is literally Hitler and that Trump is controlled by Putin. It's really quite pathetic.
Yes. Now, NATO has produced a nice little document all about autonomous drones. They're no longer science fiction, apparently. And this is, in a sense, this is kind of the same discussion as we were having with the issue of gene editing. Here is the report that they've done. Autonomous military drones, no longer science fiction. They say the possibility of life or death decisions someday being taken by machines not under the direct control of humans needs to be taken seriously. Over the last few years, we've seen a rapid development in the field of drone technology with an ever-increasing degree of autonomy. While no approved autonomous drone systems are operational as far as we know, the technology is being tested and developed. Some see the new opportunities and potential benefits of using autonomous drones. Others consider the development and use of such technologies inherently immoral. They discuss in this article such things as the legal perspectives, the fact that the law requires that a human commander who's acting in good faith make the final decision on what these weapons do. And they talk about ethics, recognizing the relevance in ethics and debates on autonomous drones. But this, you know, some of the stuff that I saw on the editing of the human embryo discussion on that online is reflected in this as well on you know, the ethical debates and whether we should pursue it, or even whether this is an unstoppable momentum. It is incredible how these ideas are being pushed forward, particularly by the sort of tech giants, without any real debate in public, it seems.
Yes, the debate is absent. The questions are absent. We haven't even got people in our parliament, or we've got terribly few, occasionally one or two, who have the ability and the strength of character to stand up and refine the question. You know, keep asking the questions and refine the questions to reveal what's really going on here. No, none of that. We seem to be sleepwalking into some very difficult areas. I mean, we're talking about life and death. We've already gone through the point where drone strikes have been ordered on, in the case of America, American citizens, without any due process. Due process has now been redefined as, well, some people had a meeting and decide you die. So you die. That's now due process. So the law's gone. And as the technology continues, well, the law, it would seem, will continue giving ground. So that all the rights that we fought, our ancestors fought so hard to establish, will be swept away.
Absolutely. Okay, David Scott, thank you very much for joining me today. Thank you for joining us. We will be back at the same time on Monday, 1 p.m, ukcolumn.org/live. Hope to see you then. And in the meantime, have a great weekend. Bye-bye.